From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. U.S. Senator Mike Rounds is also a former governor of South Dakota. He's using that insight to join a bipartisan group of former governors to ask for flexibility in how federal stabilization funds are used in individual states. He's also called for investigations into potential price gouging in beef packing. He joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh Thursday.
Senator Rounds, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you.
First, please tell us how you are doing and how you are keeping yourself safe at this point. What measures are you taking?
Several weeks ago, matter of fact, more than a month ago, we started doing basically isolation within our Washington, D.C. office. We split our staff up. We only allowed half of them to come in at a time so that, number one, we had more separation in the office. And then about 3 weeks ago, we went to basically just myself and one or two other individuals in the office to provide more separation. After that, once we left Washington, D.C., coming home, I isolated at our farm for a period of 10 days, after which time then I moved back up to my home where my wife is there. But we've basically separated out from the rest of our family, and I'm either there or basically at the office. We never have more than two other individuals in the peer office when I'm here as well. So we've done our best to try to keep those separations out, and we've tried to maintain the same individuals that worked together so that we aren't adding in other individuals into the mix. So we're doing our best to maintain that separation as recommended by CDC, and at the same time taking those good common sense approaches, lots of hand sanitizers. I've got one here on my desk. We've got one at the door coming in. And we continue to recommend, as you've heard many times before, washing hands is critical. In fact, last evening I had a town hall with I invited Senator Cassidy, Bill Cassidy, who is also a doctor, to stay on the line with me. And he emphasized and explained why hand washing works and how it takes out that virus and kills it, and why the reasoning was behind it. So we're going to continue to try to send that educational opportunity out into as many visits as possible, and once again continue to try to be an example of how to keep that isolation going.
And I think we all know in your life this is really hitting home as well because of that at-risk status. So many people are dealing with, you know, loved ones who are going through a cancer journey right now. How has that sort of changed the situation? I know my brother is in the middle of a cancer journey as well. We have lots of concerns, but we've also seen monumental efforts from his healthcare providers, and he's getting his care in Minnesota. But of people trying to figure out how do we get these cancer patients, keep them safe in ways that the urgency of that is so heightened right now.
You are correct. And anybody that has hypertension or anybody who is undergoing any kind of a chemotherapy where their immune systems have been impacted, or for a period after that, the idea is not to get them in touch with individuals that may have it or places where they could catch this particular virus. This virus is very, very dangerous, and it can impact people from any age. But what we do know is that if you have diabetes, if your immune system has been impacted, if you have high blood pressure, any of those items can add to your vulnerability. And so, you know, part of the message, as Jean and I have spoken, you know, she's been going through the cancer treatments. She's been complete now since February. And, with the last of her radiation, but we had decided early on that she would be in an isolation mode. We're even limiting the amount of time that she has available with grandkids and so forth. And, you know, they're not coming over to the house like they used to come over to the house. And, you know, our kids aren't coming into the house the way they used to come into the house and bring the family with them. So we're really trying to keep for this brief period of time, we're trying our best not to have that connection where you could catch something from somebody who has no other symptoms but might be carrying the virus. The separation is important. Once again, the good hygiene is absolutely important as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about the economy and some efforts with, you know, stimulus and stabilization money. Governor Noem was one of the early governors who expressed concerns that money might not be able to be used to shore up state revenues. Tell us a little bit about why you are gathering with these bipartisan, former governors, talking to Vice President Pence, also a former governor, about how that money can be flexible in different states.
In fact, Governor Noem and I had been in communication back and forth on a consistent basis, trying to figure out a way to get that into the original bill, because in my former role as a governor, I understood that when you have a loss of revenue because you have a slowdown in the economy, that impacts the state's ability to respond as well. Governor Noem was aware of that. She had asked if we would try our best to try to get some flexibility into the money that's coming in. We did try. We just couldn't get it successful because it takes a unanimous consent on the part of the Senate and the House to do so. But we're putting in about right at about $150 billion into, and money's going out beginning on about the 24th of April, back into your local units of government, including the states. What I had proposed and what I still believe is appropriate is that a percentage of that should be made available to the states for revenue replacement. If your sales tax is down, if your video lottery money is down, and so forth, you still got to be able to match Medicaid for to pick up federal funds. If you're a state, you still got to be able to provide those educational payments back to your local units of government, to the schools and so forth. But you've also got the ongoing operation of government itself to respond in the case of an emergency. This particular legislation that we passed, the CARES Act, does allow the states the flexibility to use it in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. So the added expenses and the costs incurred, they can take out of that $1.25 billion, which we're sending back to the state of South Dakota, but also a percentage of the money coming back to the state, about 50% of it, goes back out to your counties and to your municipalities as well. So the state will be sharing that back with those other entities of government as well. And the flexibility there is limited because we're laying out that a percentage of it has to go back and be shared with your communities and your counties. Unfortunately, what the state would really like would be to have more of it be available to pick up for that loss of revenue. I hope that in the future, and there will be probably another a phase in this, when that comes in, I'm going to lobby awfully hard to get in some flexibility so that part of that money can be used for revenue replacement.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about what does need to happen next, because this CARES Act was not the first initiative coming out of Washington. As you look at, you know, the impact that this is, and clearly there's some execution, you know, things that need to happen right now. People are complaining about, you know, the difficulty of kind of getting to this money. As those things are getting worked out, you're looking ahead at some point and saying, what happens next? Lead us, show us a little bit of what that might look like, what those early discussions are like.
And no question about it. There are improvements that can be made in the CARES Act. Senator McConnell was on the floor of the Senate this morning asking that we add additional money in for a particular part of it, which is the Payroll Protection Act. And that one is the one that has been really popular in terms of people trying to get in and get access to money as employers to keep employees on their staff rather than laying them off. And the program, I think, has some really good fundamentals in it, and it basically says, look, whatever you did last year in terms of sales and payroll, compare it with what you're doing this year, and if it's down because of the COVID-19 and you simply attest that your business is down and you believe it's due to that, you can get a loan which is forgivable, and it'll pick up your payroll up to $100,000 per employee and up to $10 million total for a period of 8 weeks. And you apply through your local banker. And what it is on top of that, 25% over and above what your payroll expenses are, you can apply against the interest on your mortgage, your utilities, the cost of doing business. And that is also a forgivable expense as well. And so the idea was is to get as much of this money out as quickly as possible back into the economy and keep these employees on the payroll with their benefits also included. The business community has just really, you know, they've grabbed a hold of this, and they've inundated our local lenders. The local lenders, in some cases, had a relationship with the SBA already, but in many cases, they did not. We've added over 30,000 additional contacts in the banks that are now doing business with the SBA. That's individual loan officers who are now accredited to send loan applications in. And we're still inundating the system with more requests from the financial side, from the banks across the country, banks, credit unions, and so forth. As it has inundated the system. Number one, the system had to be upgraded. It's growing pains, and it did not work as well as we wanted it to, but we're getting there. It's only been in effect for 5 days. The second part, we're going to run out of money because those businesses have really come forward saying, I'd much rather keep my employees on the payroll. Let's make a deal. Let me get the money. And in doing so, we've already committed $100 billion of the $300 billion, $350 billion that was in the plan. Senator McConnell was on the floor today, said, let's increase that by another $250 billion. Unfortunately, our friends on the other side of the aisle said, time out. We're not going to do that yet. We want to make it bigger. We want to go back into some other areas of the program, and we want to add money in. I think the leader's position, Senator McConnell's position, and I happen to agree with him on this, the other portions of the program in some cases have not even been dispersed yet. They wanted to increase the amount for hospitals, but we haven't sent out the first $100 billion to the hospitals yet. They wanted to increase the amount to the states by $150 billion. We haven't sent that money out yet. So I think the leader was saying, let's get this $250 in. It's unanimous. Everybody supports it. Let's get that out. And we'll look at a bigger package coming down the line. Disagreement there. We're going to have to work that out with our friends on the other side of the aisle. We'll figure this out one way or another. But nonetheless, we want to get that back in and get assurances back into these small businesses. The money will be there when they request it. That's part of what we've got to do is get that $250 in. And then after that, I'd like to see some flexibility for the states as well. I'd like to see that built in. I also would like to go back into the existing program that is there and make it clear that the SBA cannot exclude coverage for individuals that have gaming as a part of their business operation. The SBA has taken it upon themselves to add in a rule saying based upon their previous laws that don't allow the SBA to make loans to businesses that are gaming-oriented. They've now applied that to this new act, which we think is totally outdated and is the wrong interpretation. And we see that the president last evening was involved and said he's going to get involved in it to take a look at it as well. Hopefully we'll get that resolved, and a lot of our small bars, restaurants that have gaming as a part of it will now be eligible. That's the next step that we're working on at this point.
I want to talk to you a little bit about these accusations of price gouging in beef packing and how consumers are ending up seeing huge jumps in the price of their beef, but yet the cattle market drops out and commodity prices and ranchers here in South Dakota are really suffering with the market crash. Tell us a little bit about your efforts to have that looked into, explain to people what the problem is here, and then let us know is there a resolution?
Here's what's going on. Last summer, we had a plant that went down, a Tyson Foods plant went down. It was about 20% of the ability to process beef. When that happened, the price for beef on the hoof, in other words, what they would buy in the entire market, went down substantially. At the same time, the price in the showcase at the supermarket went up. And it was people that were trading within the market that were basically pushing up the price on processed foods, but also cutting back substantially on what they were expecting the producers to get for beef that are on feed. At that point, we asked for an investigation. Nothing has happened yet. So this time around, as we've watched prices for fat cattle continue to go down at the sale barns, we were seeing that prices in the grocery stores were continuing to go up. We asked the Attorney General to get involved and to look at this market because basically 80% of the entire market is controlled by four very large processors. But someplace in the middle of it, the system is not working. Look, we're not going to accuse them and say that they're doing something criminal in nature, but what I asked the Attorney General to do was to take a look and to do the investigation and find out, number one, is somebody not following the law the way that it is set up? And number two, if they are following the law and we're seeing this type of a discrepancy in the market, which clearly is not working, then what do we have to do to fix the laws that are on the book right now regarding antitrust or a fair market that our producers need to rely on? We're not going to have these markets around very long if we can't fix the problem with these folks trying to get a fair price where it's not even meeting the cost of their production for beef that are on the market today. And the other piece of this that we were concerned with is during this time in which COVID-19 is here, consumers were paying a higher price than what they were before. And at the same time, we had producers that were complaining, and appropriately so, that there was a voluntary label on these items that said product of the USA, when in fact for years the Department of Ag has allowed processors to label beef from outside the country coming in as being a product of the USA, and consumers thinking that it was a product that had been, you know, born, bred, raised, and processed here in the U.S., being shocked to find out that all they had to do was bring in boxed beef from overseas and reprocess it, and they were calling beef from 20-some other countries product of the USA. That's not a fair way to advertise beef. And so we've put in legislation that will take that product of the USA and make it only for beef that's born, raised, fed, and then processed in the U.S., And second of all, we've asked the Secretary of Ag to get involved in this and to do it by rule, because they could do it by rule today. So far, they've responded saying, "Well, we'll consider an interim rule that will allow us to allow live cattle to come in from other parts of the world and still process it and call it product of the USA." But they aren't willing to go so far as to say that it should be beef that was born, raised, fed, and processed in the U.S. And so it's a halfway measure, and it's not going far enough as far as I'm concerned.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. And Senator Rounds, I know you had this town hall last night, the virtual town hall where people could call in and ask questions. And one of the things we're hearing a lot here in South Dakota is the fact that Governor Noem is one of the only governors, we're one of the only states left in the U.S. that has not issued a statewide stay-at-home order of some sort. There's been individual executive orders and individual mandates for certain groups and in certain towns. What's your message to South Dakotans who are frustrated by the state government response, especially when they look to a state like Minnesota and they see how that state is flattened their curve rapidly through stronger actions, whereas our numbers are continually increasing exponentially? What's your message to South Dakotans who are frustrated with that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I would agree that our numbers are increasing exponentially in South Dakota. But I would say this: every single state is different, and I'm not going to criticize the governor's response when she is allowing different parts of the state to respond. Look, if you go into Jones County out here and you tell them that they ought to be stay at home in Jones County rather than working in their fields, they're going to look at you and smile and continue to work in their fields anyway. If you're going to Sioux Falls, where the mayor has been very active and I think has done a great job in sending the message that isolation is very important in that community, and I support him on what he's doing there, then I think that's appropriate as well. But different parts of South Dakota where you've got literally, 300,000 people very, very close to Sioux Falls, and yet you've got another 500,000 spread out over the rest of the state, 200 miles north to south and 400 miles east to west, to suggest that all of them should follow exactly the same rules, I'm not willing to buy into that. In some states where you've got a very high density population, sure. In South Dakota, to have the independence to be able to decide what the best approach is based on where you're living and so forth. I think we are doing a good job in that regard. And in essence, and I think Dr. Fauci made this comment, every state really does have a different approach to it. But basically, qualitatively, we are achieving a lot of the same goals as what they are asking to be done in those more densely populated states. So, you know, we're right in the middle of planting season. You got small communities all over the state that are servicing farmers and ranchers who are coming in. And as an essential part of the food supply, we got to get the wheat in the ground, got to get the corn in the ground, we've got to get the ground ready, we've got to get the fertilizer in, get the chemicals on, and so forth. They're not going to be sitting at home. They're going to be out, and they're going to be actively engaged in that. The businesses that support them need to be available to help them with it, or we really will have a shutdown in our economy here. For folks that are in the livestock industry, the same thing goes. And then you've got to have your trucking organization that are moving all these commodities back and forth as well. So in South Dakota, there is so much of what our economy is, which is considered essential and critical. A good example right now is in Sioux Falls with Smithfield, we just heard that they had, you know, a large number of individuals who had confirmed to be positive with COVID-19. We need to address it. We need to be actively engaged in it. We've got to be proactive. But that beef or that hog processing facility is critical to our food supply across the entire country. And so you can't simply just shut it down and tell everybody to go home. You've got to find a way to be as safe as possible. But if at all possible, you need to keep those facilities open.
And I think that's the follow-up question there, which is, you know, we need those critical infrastructures, you know, from the grocery store to the trucking industry to the farmers in the field to keep going, but we also need them to not drop and have a closure like we saw at Smithfield, because that not only impacts lives but can acutely impact the supply chain for the rest of the country very, very quickly. Do you think Smithfield did enough early enough?
You know, I honestly can't talk about it because I don't know enough information. I only heard about it earlier today. I had not heard about it before today. So rather than pass judgment on whether they did a good job or a so-so job, let me find out more information about it before I comment on that.
Yeah. One more question before I let you go, Senator Rounds, and it goes back to what you were talking about with Senator McConnell and the things in Washington before the coronavirus really came and we were seeing documented cases in the United States. It was a time that most people agree was really partisan and contentious in Washington. Some challenges about what we were able to get done in Congress. Have you seen that shift at all? Is there more working together than there was before, or are we seeing the impact to, you know, respond as a federal government hampered by the rancor that we, you know, all Americans kind of, you know, were participating in and were noticing before coronavirus took over as a pandemic on our shores?
Well, the elephant in the room for a while was the impeachment process, and it was very aggressive by the House. In the Senate, there was throughout that time period kind of a little bit more of a laid back approach, I should say. Republicans and Democrats alike during that time period, while we knew we had to discharge our constitutional responsibilities, and we knew that there would be differences of opinion with regard to the final outcome, in the Senate we basically all knew what the outcome was going to be with regard to the impeachment. But Democrats and Republicans have maintained a very good across-the-aisle discussion. It was there during the impeachment proceedings, and it was there after the impeachment proceedings. In fact, this morning I've had almost as many contacts with my Democrat colleagues on issues as I have with my Republican colleagues this morning. And we're talking about the same things. We're talking about how do we move forward, how do we make sure that we get this, you know, this additional 250-some billion in, and is there some common ground we could find to make this work more easily? And the same thing with our scheduling. We're discussing, you know, okay, what's the appropriate way to recommend to leadership about how we reschedule ourselves back into Washington? And is there a common approach we could all find to make recommendations to our leaders on both sides of the aisle about how we get together again in the future? Those are all going on right now, and they're across the aisle. So the discussions we're having are bipartisan in nature, and it is, and we seem to be on very good terms with folks in our committees that we're working through. a lot of that doesn't make headlines day to day, but the vast majority of the issues that we work through, even in Washington, have been bipartisan in nature. The ones that get the attentions are where there's a contentious issue involved, and people get interested in that. But they really do expect that we do the day-to-day operations as efficiently as possible. And it's kind of like back here, and when I was in the legislature back here in South Dakota, the vast majority of the discussions we had might have had differences between rural and urban, but there weren't nearly as many that were Democrat and Republican-oriented. The same thing in Washington. We've got a lot of discussions about urban versus rural and the different approaches you do in the different states. That takes a lot more time to work through sometimes than the differences between Republicans and Democrats on the mundane day-to-day issues that we face. On major issues, you know, the Green New Deal and so forth, that stuff, that brings out the rancor. But the vast majority of the discussions that we have with folks on both sides of the aisle are very, very good.
One of the big challenges leaders face is what they can tell U.S. citizens to do during a public health crisis. Can they close individual businesses preemptively? Can they require at-risk people to stay home? Can they restrict travel across state or city borders? How do they build the public trust in order to save lives? Lisa Hager and David Wiltsey are political science professors at South Dakota State, and they joined Lori on Thursday to discuss some of these concerns.
Professor Hager, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Professor Wiltsey, thanks as well.
Thank you.
David, I want to start with you because we know what works in this case. We have, you know, the facts continue to change as new models and we see social distancing, you know, put into place and then we see it work. So those facts are changing, but they're by and large agreed upon. What we really don't agree upon, it seems, is how to get to what works and how to sort of make those policies so that people do the thing that saves lives. Where do you want to start with this conversation?
Well, the place that I would generally start for most questions political like this is our partisan lens. And I kind of sound like a broken record on this, but the way that we've seen measures taken across the country so far really have ultimately come down to partisanship. And the kind of the default position that governors are taking in their response. And we're at a point now where I think six or seven states are yet to issue any kind of stay-at-home order. Like you said, they're defaulting to you shouldn't do this. It's the wise thing to do, and making appeals towards some kind of collective action on this. But these governors have all been Republican, and in the most red of the red states. So, and, you know, unfortunately, in a time where we should probably fall back on to experts and approach this from a technocratic position, we've defaulted to base partisanship.
And we sort of see that ideology in what kind of language that people are using. Is it in what they do, or is it in how they say, how they talk about what needs to be done?
Well, it's both. And ultimately, it comes down to a willingness to put emergency measures in place. And if you listen to Governor Noem on this, I mean, she defaults to language of individualism, of personal choice, and you know, kind of run-of-the-mill language and rhetoric of Republicans. And if there's any time where we need to distance ourselves from this kind of rhetoric, it's now. Government is here to solve collective action problems. This is not the kind of problem that we can default to individuals making free choices across the board. We really do need government to step in and issue orders that will restrain people's behavior in this crisis. If you look at California and their response, California got way ahead of every other state, and they issued first at the city level some very tight shelter-in-place orders, and then across the state, and they are way below the curve in terms of the spread of this virus.
Professor Hager, I want to bring you into this conversation, and let's start in the same spot, which is where, you know, some of the big picture conversations, the big picture questions and curiosity, you know, the first one being, you know, how does ideology fit into how we solve this problem? You know, what does partisanship look like, you know, in this crisis? What would you add to that as some of those big questions to ask as we look at how local leaders are responding?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo a lot of what Dave just said. I think another key part of this discussion has really fallen under what I would consider states' rights. So the federal government has not issued any sort of blanket policy regarding how states should respond to COVID-19. So they're, you know, allowing states to take action under the 10th Amendment and do what they believe is right for their particular states. And what we're seeing right now is that playing out. Many states are instituting those stay-at-home sorts of orders. Others, like Governor Noem and Governor Reynolds in Iowa, are, you know, taking an approach that uses the language of you should stay home, you shall be social distancing, those sorts of things.
What can she do and what can't she do? Because this is another question, Lisa, I want to start with you, is as we look at what's happening, you know, some of those orders in California, you know, we heard President Trump say that he was considering, you know, a quarantine of New York and New Jersey, and Governor Cuomo pushing back on that a little bit and saying, you know, we're not even sure that you can do that. So, Lisa, you, as a constitutional scholar, some of these limitations that people are running up against have to be legal, constitutional, based on civil liberties. Parse that out a little bit for me, please.
So it's not uncommon for us to see executives at any level, whether it's the president or governors, attempt to infringe on people's civil rights and liberties whenever there is some sort of emergency situation. At the national level, typically where we see this play out, and, you know, sometimes even at the state level as well, relates to things like national security. So we saw quite a bit of that with respect to responses to 9/11 and whatnot. So here we have a unique situation where it is a public health crisis. And so I think here you will see governors and the president making those executive orders, and really, what you then have as an option is for the legislatures to step in, whether that's Congress or state legislatures, to put law into place that would essentially trump those executive orders. Or you are going to see people pursuing their civil rights and liberties through the court system. And that's usually where we've seen the most traction being gained and the bigger checks on executive power in these sorts of situations.
So do you anticipate, or have you seen so far, people taking those kinds of measures in places where there have been stricter stay-at-home orders?
I have not seen anything. I'll be honest that I haven't actually looked to see if there's been any sort of judicial proceedings taking place. It might still be a little early. I do believe that it tends to be the case where most people are agreeing with these stay-at-home orders. You know, what I've noticed is that there's quite a few people, and this is just anecdotally kind of looking at comments on various tweets and Facebook posts relating to what governors are doing or not doing, that people would really like to see more stay-at-home orders being put in place. You know, really, let's try to nip this COVID-19 in the bud, you know, try to stop the spread, flatten the curve, so that we can eventually go back to normal life, hopefully sooner rather than later. So, but I think the longer that these sorts of measures are in place, and potentially as they are instituted in areas with lower levels of cases, you could see some court proceedings.
Yeah, I've not seen any judicial proceedings myself, but I have seen scattered reports, particularly in the Mountain West, of certain groups and individuals who are just openly defying these sorts of orders. And those are the sorts of things that are going to put these judicial questions into play. Eamon Bundy, who was famous for taking over that National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon, he and a few of his followers or friends, whatever you want to call them, they're systematically ignoring Idaho's order right now just to force this issue. But I think Lisa is right. For the most part, people default to let's wait for the crisis to abate, and then we can have a more detailed discussion about the proper balance between state and federal authorities, what is and is not overreach after the danger has subsided.
One of the things that they are doing in New Zealand is this effort to make it sharp and short, and the pressure largely came from businesses there who said, you know, the economic impact of doing this for a long time, of closing businesses for a long time, you know, to flatten the curve is devastating to us, and they put pressure on New Zealand government to do it all right now, a month at home, two 14-day cycles, close the borders, let no one in, and then we'll be open again in a month. And New Zealand is having a great amount of success with that. David, how difficult, though, when you try to take that kind of idea of sharp and short versus, you know, long and drawn out, or, you know, what are the minimal amount of restrictions that we can get, you know, that we can get into place that we think people can sustain for a long period of time? Talk about that a little bit with, you know, how drastic would it have to be? I mean, would you have to close the borders in South Dakota? Do you have to close the interstates and the highways? Like, what? It's hard to get your mind around because it's so different from how we normally live and what we expect to be able to do.
Right, and a lot of this just boils down to the system of governance that New Zealand has. I'd have to look up to be for sure about this, but I'm pretty sure New Zealand has a unitary system where all political power ultimately resides in the national government. Just the federal system here complicates this immensely. And because certain powers are reserved to the state and certain powers are reserved to the federal government here, doing something like closing an interstate or closing a state border is not something that a governor can just unilaterally do in normal times. And I would certainly default to Lisa on this in terms of the constitutionality of it. But politically, that's not something that governors are willing to do just for the political stake. And that's going to lead to 50 different responses across the country, which is not going to be ideal when it comes to containing the growth of this virus on a national scale. Individual states might be able to do a lot better than others, but we're still going to be behind the curve just because of how we divide political power in this country.
Yeah. Let's talk about leadership and transparency and public trust, because if there are limitations, you know, because one of the things, again, Lisa, Governor Noem has talked about is it really hinting at this idea of willingness and compliance and sustainability. What are you willing to do for a longer period of time? And I'm wondering about some of the pressures that we've seen on the Department of Health to release more information that they say, you know, they're withholding for privacy about where some of these hotspots are, and how their willingness to be open with people, to remain calm, but also to embrace the models as they exist and to have an awareness of what's happening in a state like Minnesota, which is clearly doing a better job right now of flattening the curve than South Dakota appears to be doing. Talk a little bit about that, Lisa, if you will, this notion of what's the role of just plain, you know, transparency and leadership in this time to encourage and gain trust and encourage compliance and encourage a willingness for people to sacrifice together.
Right. So transparency and trust are going to be key in getting people to actually go along with any sort of stay-at-home order or just the suggestion that you should be staying home. from what I've been reading, it appears that the Department of Health has really struggled to be able to test people quickly enough and then get that data released in the first place. And so I think that's one issue that South Dakota is having. You know, I've just seen multiple articles of how many cases there are in each county and then how many cases have then recovered. And oftentimes you see those numbers rise together. And so that has been something that people have noticed, that the information is just not getting out very quickly. And so I think then that makes people start to wonder, well, if there were people who had COVID-19 and then were just learning about the test that came back positive, but yet they're already recovered, you know, what were they doing during that time when they were sick, or maybe when they were sick and they didn't know it? So I think it does make it somewhat difficult for people to have enough trust in the decisions that are being made. But at the same point, having those sorts of data come out makes people realize, you know, we really don't know who is sick or who could be sick or who is sick. And so it is very important to try to follow these stay-at-home orders or, you know, social distancing measures just to, you know, try to avoid catching COVID-19.
David, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning about partisan lens, you know, through which we see government. And, you know, Governor Noem talked about, you know, early on in one of the press conferences was, I want to talk to you for a moment about the role of government in a crisis. And then she laid out those beliefs for people. South Dakota State Legislature on veto day, you could see the struggles they had with, you know, trying to come, as all of us do, trying to do their jobs in this whole new way, but also struggling with what their role was and how to enact it. Was a lot of this just sort of waiting, you know, because South Dakota has, such a small government. We run on a very small government, a very lean government to begin with. Is a state like South Dakota then less prepared for this? And our elected officials are less likely to have really even thought about what if this happened, because they don't see that that's the role of government at all?
I wouldn't say they haven't thought about it, but what you say about state capacity, I think, is absolutely correct. We just don't have the kind of infrastructure that a lot of other states do. And even if we were to have leadership that was willing to aggressively pursue some of the avenues that other states have, I don't know that they could. But I just want to, you know, kind of circle back to this whole question about trust and leadership. Governors have actually been doing fairly well on this. I think most people across the country are kind of defaulting to a rally effect towards governors. And there's a few governors. I know Ron DeSantis is in trouble when it comes to overall trust and approval of his handling of this. We haven't seen any polls yet on Governor Noem, since we don't do these kinds of statewide polls that often. But we do have a real capacity issue here. So even if we did have high trust in government, I don't think that state government here is really up to it in terms of their infrastructure to aggressively take the kinds of measures that say is happening just across the border in Minnesota.
In a recent press conference, Governor Kristi Noem praised the city of Huron for their efforts to deal with the outbreak. The challenge in South Dakota is far from over, but on Wednesday, we welcomed Huron Mayor Paul Aylward and Huron Public Information Officer Mark Johnson back to the program to give us an update.
Mayor Aylward, thanks for being here. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Glad to be here, too.
Mark Johnson, thanks for being here, too.
No problem. Thanks for having us back.
Let's start with you, Mayor, and tell us a little bit about how things have unfolded from an ordinance and a standpoint and some of the actions that you had taken, you know, early on and how they stand today. Just give us the general update from here on, please.
Sure, I'd be glad to. On the 22nd of March, we held a special meeting of the Sharon City Commission in joint with the Beadle County Commission. And after much discussion that day and tossing around different options, we decided to pass an ordinance and a resolution that basically was a shutdown of our city and our county. The county commission also passed the same resolution and ordinance as we did. That was went into effect at midnight, March 23rd. And since then, as you know, we have done pretty well on our containing the virus and maybe at least flattening out the curve of where we're at. For, I believe, a week or so now, we have had no new positive cases. And so that is good. We think that the efforts that we took on the 23rd, 22nd meeting went into effect that night at midnight on the 23rd, have worked. And we hope that that is the case and that we stay on that path with no more new cases of positive cases of the coronavirus.
Mayor, the last time we talked, we also talked about contact tracing because there were rumors across the state about, you know, who these cases were impacting, and you cleared those up last time. But I want to get to this idea of what did you know, you know, I'm not asking for privacy information to be released, but did you have enough information to find out where those cases were concentrated, if they were concentrated together, in a way to contact everybody you know, who might have been exposed and have them self-isolate? What was that process like for you, for mayors who haven't had this come to their town yet or to their county? What is that communication like between the Department of Health and the people who are sick so you can get the information out that keeps other people safe?
Well, the Department of Health give us limited information. They would only tell us that the cases were from Beadle County. They did the tracking themselves, and they do not devolve that information. We did have some rumors that it was being carried by our immigrant population. They did tell us that all of the cases, positive cases in Beadle County were from Caucasian. That was the basic information that we got, and that's what we released to the public.
Hmm. Would you have wanted to know more? Did you feel like that was enough?
Well, I think that was basically enough. We really do respect people's privacy in this. We have had, you know, as it's probably been reported, one of our local legislators, Representative Bob Glanzer, was infected, a positive, and has since passed away. His family released that information. So that... you know, I think answered a lot of questions for a lot of people. So a lot of people knew Bob Glanzer, and that was the only information that we knew, which was released by his family.
Hmm. Talk for a minute about Bob and just the loss that is for people who are facing, you know, this illness. It's very personal. I'm sorry to hear of the loss. I didn't know him personally, but how does it affect a community like Huron to know someone who was prominent in the community and represented, you know, Beadle County or represented that district, I should say, in Pierre? How are people sort of taking that loss and grieving? And meanwhile, all these other things are going on.
Well, there's been a big outpouring of for his family. He was very prominent in his church and was well known throughout the community, having served in different jobs here in Huron. He was the manager of the state fair for a number of years. He also was a banker here in town, and he was very, very well noted throughout Beadle County. But in Huron, I believe almost everyone knew Bob Glanzer.
Mm. Mark, I want to talk with you a little bit and tell me about how people are responding to the restrictions, to isolation, to the economic impact and the closure of businesses. What are you sort of hearing about, you know, the early success of the actions that were taken, but then also are you noticing restlessness to say, you know, what is normal look like in the coming days?
Well, currently, I think our citizens and residents are doing a really good job of still supporting our local businesses, whether it be through takeout programs or delivery at or pickup at the door. They're still able to get their services. They're helping each other out. They're coming together to make sure they are still supporting their businesses. It's a culture shock for everybody, and a lot of us have had to adapt to it. And for the most part, everybody is working together and taking the recommendations and following the ordinances and resolutions that our elected officials passed back on March 22nd.
Are people concerned about how long they might go on, or is the community of Huron sort of just, you know, we're all in this together? What's the overall? And I'm, you know, it's not monolithic, of course, and everybody has their own, you know, their own thoughts. But are you getting a sense of how people are sort of mentally approaching this challenge?
It's a combination of both what you said earlier there, where people are like, they're seeing the numbers coming from the Department of Health we've been maintaining, but at the same time, we can't let our guard down, and they're, you know, coming up with their action plans to sustain what they may have to do for however long this takes. As the governor's made mention that this is a marathon, this isn't a sprint. So I think for the most part, everybody's doing their due diligence. They're working through this, you know, the new way of doing things for the time being until our elected leaders decide to lift their restrictions that they've put in place. But for the time being, everybody's doing pretty much what they should be doing and following the guidance that's been enacted and following what our federal leaders have even put out there.
Mayor, this is a city, as Governor Noem pointed out, that had, you know, an early situation, responded strongly, saw immediate results from those responses, and is now, I like what Mark said there, sort of developing an action plan for sustaining these actions. Anything else you would like to add, Mayor, before we let you go back to your busy schedules?
Well, I would just like to add that the public information that I'm getting, the people that have called me, who have texted me, who have written letters to the editor, almost all of them have been positive. And the people do believe that we are on the right path. And I think Huron is a pretty strong community. And when they decide to do something, they stick with it. So I'm really proud of the way the people of Huron have responded. We are all in this together. And I think that's the attitude that's been shown here.
As America faces the coronavirus pandemic, many also warn of a mental health pandemic. Dr. Matt Stanley is a psychiatrist with Avera Health. He joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh on Wednesday to, well, break down the concern.
Dr. Stanley, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, as always, thanks for having me. Great to speak to you and appreciate the opportunity to reach out to others.
I think it is an important time to stop and say for many people, before this even happened, we're in crisis for a variety of reasons, through depression or anxiety or PTSD or addiction, or their lives were already upended and then this happened. So I want to start with you, if we could. How have those services for people who were already in need, have they been interrupted? How has that transition sort of keep employees and healthcare providers and patients safe, but also continuing to get the care that they need? How has that gone?
Yeah, well, you bring up a tremendous challenge, one of many challenges we've faced with this unprecedented pandemic. But, you know, I think, as you're implying, the other illnesses, the other issues that we've all been dealing with, and as a health system, we're here to take care of, didn't go on pause as we had to try to learn how to deal with the coronavirus. So we have had to balance between keeping people safe and limiting exposure, but still providing services to those that have ongoing needs, whether it's as you said, you know, life-threatening diseases like depression and suicide, or all the other mental illnesses we deal with. And certainly in any time of uncertainty, our anxiety disorders escalate, as well as things like depression and even things like substance abuse and some of the psychotic disorders. So we are still out there serving the community and addressing what's always been our primary focus in healthcare.
This is an organization as well that had recently had some, you know, disruption and innovative solutions after a tornado took care of or you know, came through the town and impacted services a little bit. Tell me, have you noticed that the fact that that staff had already had to think outside that box, had already had to very recently respond to something that, you know, they really hadn't, you know, imagined before? Did that help at all in the, okay, here's the next thing that we have to figure out?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question, and I think it's a brilliant question because, honestly, I don't think most people would see that aspect of it. But I think you're absolutely correct. I think one of the things, and we see this, I think, in our community, maybe nationally, maybe across the entire world, challenges sometimes tend to bring us together. They certainly often challenge us to rise to a level we weren't aware we could achieve or weren't prepared to try for. So I do think that our staff, first of all, showed an amazing resilience through the tornado. And I think they're brilliant people going far over and above what they probably realized they could do. So I do think, oddly, it's probably not a normal expectation that we would come out of these kind of challenges stronger, but I think we have. And I'll tell you, you know, I would say it's hard to say there's a silver lining in something that's as traumatic and, you know, taking lives like this illness is, but there are some amazing changes, advances that are being propelled by this pandemic, such as I think telemedicine is just going to be advanced dramatically through this crisis, and the responses we've been forced to implement.
Yeah. Even as we go through this, we are, I think, in our individual lives, and then, you know, as in the institutions or the employers we work for or with, we're learning these little things that say, oh, that's a glimmer of, now that I'm forced to do it, it's a little bit of a better way to do it, or there's at least a potential to look forward, which I don't think minimizes, you know, the suffering that we're experiencing now. But it does kind of get to this idea that the normal that some people are hoping for, maybe normal isn't the right word. Maybe just next is the right word, or you know, looking forward instead of looking back. How do we return to what we were doing versus how do we move forward knowing what we know now? I want to talk to you, Dr. Stanley, a little bit about people who are suffering in new ways, people who, you know, have lost their jobs, people who are desperate, anxious, hurting, lonely, isolated in ways they've really never experienced before. What's your message to people about getting help, how to get help, and why it's okay to get help?
Yeah, well, those are some pretty weighty questions right there. It is absolutely, as you said, it's normal now. And I think one of the things we see in psychiatry and behavioral health is that sometimes just to normalize responses, to be anxious, to be worried, to be maybe even to a degree distraught, is not abnormal right now. I think the biggest concern we have is that exactly what you're implying, that you would lock yourself away, think that you know something's wrong with you, and be embarrassed or afraid to ask for help. When we go through times like we're going through, it is normal for people to need and hopefully to seek help. I think you mentioned a lot of the stressors, loss of job, isolation, you know, anxiety that and people that probably have never or possibly have never experienced this kind of anxiety before. But the resources are there. We're aware that things are very stressful for, I would say, most of America, maybe most of the world. People I work with, behavioral health professionals, our stress level is up. We are all dealing with things that we weren't necessarily prepared for or expecting. So let me mention a couple of resources. You know, Avera Health has teamed with the helpline, so that's 211, for people that are struggling during this time. And I think one of the beauties of teaming with the helpline is the helpline has always been excellent at directing people toward community resources, whether it's volunteer work or, in this case, maybe help with housing or emergency resources. And we've teamed with them so that if people call in and they need those kind of things that 211 normally deals with, 211 will kind of take and manage that call or direct that call. But if someone calls in with a need for some counseling, some anxiety issues or depression issues, then that call moves over to our 24/7 counselors who are prepared to work with people on the phone and both counsel them in the moment, but also direct them to other resources and direct them to the right level of care. Also want to point out, you know, although we're trying to limit people going into clinics at this point in time, our clinics are trying to move over to almost all telemedicine visits. And that is, as you can imagine, a tremendous challenge within a week or two to move from face-to-face appointments to telemedicine. But there are apps that can be downloaded. Avera Now is an app we're using so that you can actually do a visit on your smartphone. But emergency resources, you can still walk into our behavioral health facility for an assessment. So resources are still available. And if you don't feel like you've quite gotten to that level where you need to maybe seek help of professional nature, I think there are a few things that we are learning in a broader sense. Sometimes just that we're inundated with the information about the coronavirus right now. It dominates our lives, understandably so. I think if you find your anxiety escalating, you should learn to limit maybe your exposure to those sources. Certainly only stick to credible sources. I think the other thing that's going on is there's, you know, this is a new event for us in many ways, both the nature of the disease and our response to it. So I think you need to stick to trusted sources. If you do need information, it certainly is important to be informed. I'm not suggesting that you lock yourself away from that. But you mentioned isolation as well. I think it's a wonderful time to reach out and reconnect with people, especially people that have been supportive in the past, family members. I find myself doing more of that now. Again, maybe one of those silver linings where I see more families out in their yards, engaging in activities I haven't seen for maybe years. So some of the positives, you know, that ability to reach out, to reconnect. Obviously, we need to maintain social distancing. We need to maintain our hand washing and our cleanliness. But there are some opportunities for support and strengthening here.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about the impact of chronic stress, just the physiological stress, because that's one of the things, you know, in this job that we struggle with is that, you know, we're in that sort of information soup every day and we're pushing for questions to things as, you know, things are not set in stone. And what's the next question to move the conversation forward, to help people know what they need to know. And you can feel that physically. You can feel it in different people are feeling it in different ways in their body, whether it's a headache or a stomach ache or a tightening of your throat or, you know, somebody else's hands might be shaking. We all have a physical response. Talk a little bit about how important it is to address that physical response and find a place of physical calm, as well as, you know, sort of walking away from the information that might be causing it, but getting to that physical space where at least you feel like a normal human being again.
Yeah.
And how, if you don't do that, what can it do? I remember the other day we were getting ready for something. My heart was just racing. And I was like, you have to calm that down now. Because I don't know where that ends if you don't. I mean, that could be a real health risk for people.
Yeah, and not to get too deep into the physiology of the anxiety, but when you stay at an elevated level of anxiety, it does affect hormones, particularly cortisol, which then triggers other events in your body. You know, we're all familiar with that concept of fight or flight, and to have your body always in a heightened state of awareness, a heightened reactionary state, does wear on you and can create prolonged mental and physical effects and changes. So you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's in your health interest to control that. I think one of the things to remember about anxiety is, you know, anxiety so often is really based on just being unsure or out of control. You can't control the situation, or you can't control what's occurring. So the counter to that at times is action, or to have a plan. And so I think, you know, we talked about some of the things you can do to maybe limit sources, but I think physically, one of the things that I think many people are struggling with is they're laid off from work, so the actual structure of their life is lost. So some of the simplest things, and of course we apply this to many areas of health, is stay on structure, get a good night's sleep, go to bed at the same time, get up at the same time, exercise when you can, eat well. But I think when you're talking about that anxiety, you were feeling that heart rate, flushing, whatever it may be, you know, very simply deep breathing can often be one way to calm down. You used actually self-talk. You said, come on, you got to calm down, get this under control. That can also be a powerful method. I think in deep breathing, people underestimate it. It sounds so simple, but it's actually very powerful. And I think one of the concepts of deep breathing is you exhale more slowly than you inhale. It's both kind of a subconscious and a conscious way to regain control, but also that idea that exhaling, you're kind of blowing out, you know, releasing the problem that is pent up within you. I think this is a wonderful time, if some of us have more time on our hands, to explore some of the apps that are out there to help us relax, or even to contemplate meditation. The benefits of meditation have been pretty well documented as well. So I think there are some tools we can employ. I'm a strong believer in the deep breathing, and the physical component of your health is critical. Exercise, I think, again, something as simple as stretching, very valuable in times like this when our body is maintaining a level of tenseness or anxiety that we're sometimes it gets to be so normal we're not aware how tense we are.
Black Hills National Forest is at a crossroads. SDPB Seth Tupper joined us with an update on the developing conversation around timber cuts and forest sustainability.
And now Seth Tupper is with us, SDPB Seth Tupper, who's going to give us an update on the Black Hills National Forest at a crossroads. We talked about this a little bit last week, and Seth was able to attend virtually the meeting and the conversation about where that situation is at. And he's joining us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's downtown Rapid City space. Seth, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Give us a quick update for people who missed that conversation last week about how this meeting was held and why it was being held.
Yeah, so it was last Friday. It was supposed to be in the Black Hills National Forest headquarters in Custer, but of course, because of coronavirus, that couldn't happen. So they had it by teleconference. You could call into a number, and you also could watch a presentation screen at the same time. And there was a little number that showed the number of people. I saw at one time about 175 people were called in. So that's an indication of how important this is and how many people are interested in it. But the reason the meeting was held was because, you know, we of course had the mountain pine beetle epidemic in the Black Hills from 1998 to 2016. We've also been through a period of larger and more frequent wildfires. The three largest wildfires in the recorded history of the Black Hills have all been in the past 20 years. And so the beetles and the fires have killed millions of trees in the last couple of decades. And yet, the Black Hills National Forest is still producing more timber by volume than any other national forest in the country. And so we're at a place now where people are asking, is that sustainable? Should we reduce the amount of logging that's being done? And they had this meeting because in the past couple of years, the Forest Service has sped up an analysis of trying to figure out how many trees are there out there in the forest. And they did an analysis using ground plots and aerial imagery and a lot of math, and estimated the volume of trees in the forest. And that data is out, and they presented it at this meeting and took some comments from some of the interested parties.
All right. A lot of information here and some emotion as well in the meeting. So we're going to go. Seth has brought some audio from that meeting for folks to listen to. And let's just get started at the top and go through some of these voices so we can hear as many as possible. Tell us first what the Forest Service had to say.
Yeah, so Andrew Johnson, he is the acting supervisor of the Black Hills National Forest, and he basically framed the debate before they got started, and here's what he had to say.
So as most of you know, the Black Hills National Forest has the longest history of timber management and partnership between stakeholders like industry and the Forest Service of any national forest in the system, starting with the Case 1 timber sale. Case 1, when the Gifford Pinchot collaborated with industry to craft the first timber sale for the Forest Service, more importantly, initiated a relationship with industry to sustainably manage the timber of the Black Hills. Case 1 changed the course of management of the Black Hills from unsustainable and unregulated harvest to management informed by science. Our management has evolved over time, but is still and must still be informed and guided by science.
And I should jump in and say he mentioned Case 1. That was the, in 1899, an agreement between the Homestake Gold Mine and the Department of Interior that became the first timber sale in what we now call the National Forest System. And then he mentioned Gifford Pinchot, who was the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service, who was instrumental in that agreement. So
a lot of history here, yeah. What else from the Forest Service before we hear some of these other voices of environmentalists and conservationists? Forest Service voices next?
So after they set the debate up a little bit, they had Mike Battaglia. He's a research forester from the Forest Service office in Fort Collins, Colorado, and he revealed some of the research that they've been working hard to produce.
So let's start with the scenarios. So scenario one, the worst case scenario, this is the scenario that shows high mortality rates throughout the scenario, and we start with the 2019 harvest level. And that's here shown in this red line, and this is what we see is if we continue harvest levels at 153,000 CCF, we've run out of saw timber within the next 34 years.
And so, yeah, to unpack that a little bit, you heard that mention of CCF. That's a unit of volume that's equal to 100 cubic feet. I've had a forester explain that to me. If you imagine a cord of firewood that's 8 feet long, 4 feet high, and 4 feet wide, one CCF would be a little bit less than that. And so 153,000 CCF is what they harvested last year.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that's the number they're working on. But he says that if they kept harvesting timber at that pace, they could deplete the forest of saw timber in 34 years. And that's an important point. They're not saying they're going to run out of trees, but they're saying that they could deplete the forest of saw timber, which is a particular tree that's at least 9 inches in diameter, basically at the height of a person's chest, that's suitable for logging. So,
which essentially means everything grinds to a halt at that point.
For the timber industry, yep.
For the timber industry, right. Okay.
And other consequences could flow out of that. Obviously, if we don't have timber, we have a dense forest and other consequences there as well, which we can get into.
Right. All right. Conservationists, they showed up to be heard as well.
Yeah, and so the Forest Service is pretty good about this. They have a group out here called the Black Hills National Forest Advisory Committee where they get stakeholders around the table from all the different groups. And a lot of those people participated in this meeting. And they didn't really, the environmentalist conservation groups didn't really call for a certain number, a harvest number, but they did express their concerns. And this audio is a little rough. Obviously, it depends on the quality of a person's phone connection. But one of the people who commented was Bob Burns. He's the president of the Norbeck Society here in the Black Hills, which advocates for the sustainable use of public lands.
The annual volume of timber sold must be reduced. We must return to our roots and let the Forest Service use science and true partnership with the timber industry. The annual volume sold needs to be at a level that can be sustained into perpetuity.
So these people are saying, you know, we have this new data, and this is what it clearly says. Let's take action now. Do I understand that fairly clearly, or is it more nuanced than that?
No, that's it. I mean, they're saying that we need to reduce logging levels significantly in the Black Hills in order to, you know, sustain the timber into perpetuity. And it wasn't just environmentalists and conservationists. It was also there was a retired Forest Service employee, Dave Mertz, who said he spoke for a lot of other Forest Service retirees who are concerned about what's happening in the Black Hills. And here's a little of what he had to say.
We're cutting down our future. Why did we do it? Why did we do it now? To meet the timber target.
And that was a little rough, but he said, we're cutting down our future. And when he said, we're doing it because of timber targets. And what he means by that is there's an allowable sale quantity that was set many years ago for the Black Hills National Forest for the amount of timber that's sold out of the forest. And he says that Forest Service employees feel a lot of pressure to keep timber harvest near that target. And that's what's kept the harvest at a high level, even though foresters within the Forest Service know that the resource is being somewhat depleted or is in danger of being depleted over time.
All right. And voices from the timber industry, what did those people have to say?
Yeah, so there were a lot of people on the call from the timber industry and, people whose livelihoods depend on logging or you know, building roads for loggers or you know, servicing the timber industry in some way. And one of those people was Jeff Parrott. He's the senior business development manager for Wheeler Lumber in Whitewood, just up the road from Rapid City here. And they do work with timber, including timber bridge manufacturing. And he talked a little bit about how crucial the timber industry is to the Black Hills economy.
There's over 1,400 people that work in the forest products industry here in the Black Hills, and hundreds of millions of dollars go back into our local economy. We don't want to see that another company fail, and as we know it now, that could crush the economy here in the Black Hills, not unlike what's happening with this pandemic right now.
Yeah, important context there.
Yeah, and then there was Tim Danley. He's a vice president of Forest Products Distributors in Rapid City. They do posts and heating pellets, and they do some logging and road building, he said. And he was more passionate and put a sharper point on what Jeff Parrott was talking about. And here's what Tim Danley said.
Forest products companies are not the enemy. We are a major tool that the Black Hills National Forest has in maintaining a healthy forest for over hundreds of years.
And in summary, so the forest groups out here are the forest businesses. The timber businesses have an association called the Black Hills Forest Resource Association. And they have an executive director, Ben Woodkey, who kind of drew all this together and argued that in the absence of uncontrolled wildfires, which used to manage the forest before Europeans came along and started suppressing wildfires, that in the absence of that, we need logging to basically manage the forest. And he said that if we don't have enough logging, we'll get in trouble ecologically. Here's what he said.
In conclusion, just as the Black Hills found themselves at a crossroads in the late 70s following the previous mountain pine beetle epidemic, we're at another crossroads now, and we have a choice. We can continue to manage the forest in an effort to reduce our risk of mountain pine beetles and catastrophic wildfires, or we can make the choice to grow it back to the place that promulgated these very events that we've been seeing, the mountain pine beetle epidemics and wildfires that risk loss of life and property. We do have a choice in all of this, and I hope that we can make the right choice out of this.
And when he says, you know, grow it back to the way it was, and the problems, he's talking about, you know, a dense forest, which is, you know, is right. bad. It can fuel wildfires, and also is believed to, you know, beetles are believed to thrive on a dense forest.
All right. So is the data in the new research having more information than ever before helping this conversation in its clarity, or are the facts still in doubt, depending on which side of the aisle you're on here?
It's the latter. Yeah. So the Forest Service and some of the environmental conservation groups, the retired foresters, they all said, hey, we have the data. This is not the time to debate the data. The data's in. Now it's time to take action and make decisions. But the timber industry groups, those that you just heard from, they took issue with some of the data and questioned whether it was accurate. And they poked some holes in it here and there and found what they thought were some mistakes on the data. They disputed what's called the suitable base for timber harvest, which is not all the forest is considered suitable for logging. Only a certain amount of acres are, and they believe that that acreage is too small. And so going forward, it'll be interesting to see how that takes shape, how they continue to try to poke holes in that data, and if we get stuck on analyzing the data, or if there's some further discussion and action going forward.
All right, Seth Tupper, keep us posted. Thanks so much for your help.
You're welcome.
How are college students coping with going directly from being newly independent to back at home all day? How can parents help high school students dealing with missing out on things like prom, for example? Carrie Oyen is an assistant professor of school psychology at the University of South Dakota, and she joined us on Monday to tell us how the role of school counselors and psychologists has changed, as well as give some tips to parents who are, well, dealing with some of these issues.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I guarantee you there's so much to talk about that our time will feel way too short, and I promise whatever we don't get to, we'll invite you back. So we'll lay that on the table now. But I want to start with, I think everybody has a basic understanding of just how much this knocked everybody off of their routine, how stressful it is, the tension at home, the time together. But I want to start with some behavior issues first. Are we seeing, do you expect to see, are you hearing from parents that some of this is really presenting itself, some of that tension is presenting itself with behavioral issues, from a 7-year-old temper tantrum to a 17-year-old temper tantrum?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. You know, I think that I'm hearing from lots of different sources just about how this stress affects a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. One of the things that we know so much about kids is that kids really look to adults for guidance on how to react to stressful events. And so oftentimes kids are, you know, seeing how adults are responding in their environment, and that may then in turn have them responding. Now, the thing that's really interesting about kids is that sometimes their responses are different than what we would expect for other aged people. So instead of being verbal about their concerns, we might see things like temper tantrums. We might also see things like extra clingy, you know, not really wanting you to leave the room, some of those kinds of things. Sometimes as kids get older, like adolescents and teenagers, you might see more withdrawal behavior, kind of that irritability, which tends to happen anyway as kids get to be teenagers. It turns out their parents aren't quite as cool to them anymore. But again, I think there are some warning signs, you know, if kids are not enjoying things that they previously enjoyed, if they have an inability to initiate tasks, some of those kinds of things. Again, those are things that we're concerned about. And I do think that it's wise for us to be aware that this could be related to stress related to the coronavirus.
Right. And some of that stress was there before. I know some college parents I've talked to have said, you know, there was already a lot of pressure or stress, and now it's compounded. I want to go back to something you said about kids looking to adults for guidance. And I can just hear every parent who's listening right now going, great. More pressure on me. Now I'm supposed to be calm, too. Talk a little bit to parents and families who are just dealing with the reality of imperfection right now. That, you know, are we damaging our kids for a lifetime because, you know, we cry at night or because, you know, we slammed the dishes last night and said, I can't do this anymore? Help parents sort of sort their own fallibilities out here?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, I am a working mom, so I'm a professor, but I'm also a mom of two children, 13 and 10. And I do feel those same pressures of trying to not only work from home, but also, you know, feed everybody. Now all of a sudden I've opened my own academy, right? The Oyen Homeschool Academy that I was not planning on opening. And I think it's easy to become overwhelmed in all the different tasks that we have to do. I think, first of all, just remember that it's impossible to do all those things at the same time. So I think that it's really important to take it one step at a time. The other thing that I've really been hearing over and over again, and what's been really helpful for my family, is to really establish a routine. And so there's all these things that we're uncertain about, and there's all these things that we can't control. You know, we can't control what other people are doing. We can't control, you know, if other people are getting COVID-19, and there's all these things outside of our control. But what we can control are the things that are happening, you know, as we're safe in our houses. We can control how we talk to our kids, saying to kids that, you know, there's a lot of adults that are really working hard to keep you safe. And part of the way that we can stay safe is by staying home and in establishing that routine and being calm. And then also finding mechanisms for adults to take care of themselves. One of my favorite resources that I love to share with parents is, it's actually from the National Association of School Psychologists, and it's called Care for the Caregiver. And it's kind of like that corny safety demonstration on the airplane where they say that you have to put the oxygen mask on yourself before you can put it on someone else. And that remains true more today than probably ever, that you really do need to take care of yourself so that you can take care of others in your house. And that might be things that are like making sure you get enough rest, eating well, again, establishing your own routine, exercising. I've been making myself walk on my country roads. Again, those things are really good for your mental health.
Yeah. Is there a way to give kids a sense of control, whether that's a teenager or a little kid? Because some of these kids and their behavior that I'm hearing about really seems like, you know, they're grabbing for control of a situation, you know, because so much is out of control. Can we figure out a way to give them more choices and more control and more input into how things are happening at home?
I just love that you brought that up. I think that, again, a few things. First of all, I do think it's really important that we're available for our kids. I think that we really need to be mindful about how much viewing of social media, how much viewing of the news we have for kids, because, again, it can be fear-inducing, and sometimes unnecessarily so. I think when it comes to choice, I think that it can be really important to say to kids, you know, what times of the day do you think we should have academic times? And what times of the day do you want to do free time? And during free time, what kinds of things can we do? And kind of help them be a part of the problem solving for all of us as we're establishing our routines. For my own kids, we've been doing a lot of cooking, and so I let them, you know, choose what are some things that we might be able to cook. And then I also think that it's really important, especially for kids that are on, you know, I think about seniors in high school. I even think about seniors in college, those that are really at this place where they have fairly significant milestones where they can feel like they might be missing out. I think it is really important to validate their experience and say that this is a loss. But I think we also have to believe and have faith that kids are so creative and they can really find ways, if we allow them to have the space, you know, find ways to create new memories and new milestones and really be more of a facilitator of creativity, because we do know that we have a fairly socially connected crowd, especially our young adults. Mm-hmm. And I do think that by allowing them to explore that space, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the stress lessen and maybe some of the connectivity increased.
One of the tough things about covering this pandemic has been the rate at which things have changed and developed. So keep in mind that this interview took place on Monday, but we invited on Mayor Steve Allender of Rapid City to the program to let us know what's happening over there.
Mayor Allender, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Good morning.
All right. It's been a trying time for everyone. How are you feeling? And how are you sort of just, you know, how are people in Rapid City, you know, kind of holding up from a health perspective and are you keeping yourself safe?
Well, I think we are keeping ourselves as safe as practical. There's definitely an attitude change and behavior change and how people are acting out here. And I think it's good that it's temporary, and it's also good. I think it's helping the keep the spread of the disease at a reasonable rate at the moment.
Let's talk a little bit about authority and responsibility and who makes which calls. Governor Noem issued an executive order and talked about what the guidance should be in cities, and different mayors across the state have responded in different ways. What has your response been, and where do you stand now on whether the state's guidance is strong enough to save as many lives as possible and where your authority rests? Just expand on that topic first, please.
Sure. Well, I think the governor has the authority to do the most good in a public health crisis. And that may have been in question early on in the mind of our governor. I think now there have been some emergency legislation passed. I don't think the concern is the same. But I hope people can realize and appreciate that cities only get their authority from the state. Without the state, we have no authority whatsoever. And so in most South Dakota municipalities, if there's not an existing state law expressly authorizing cities to do something, then there's no authority to do it. In home rule communities, they have a little broader spectrum of options for exercising local authority. So the person or the entity that gives that authority is the governor. So all the authority rests there. So we have done what we believe can be done legally and practically at this point with the closing of bars, restaurant dining rooms, recreational facilities. And beyond that, we are recommending social distancing. But as I'm talking to you right now, I'm looking out over Memorial Park in Central Rapid City, and I see a group of individuals sitting on the sidewalk, all in very close proximity to one another. And so there's great examples of how people are practicing social distancing and great examples of how they're not. So as far as authority goes, I think we're cleared up. We're mostly cleared up on that in Rapid City as to where we stand. There are some other communities across the state. They're a little less confident about their authority and have now signed a letter asking the governor to declare a public health emergency in South Dakota.
And that letter came from the South Dakota Municipal League. Did you sign that letter as well, Mayor Allender?
I did. 151 mayors across South Dakota signed it, and nine or 12 county officials signed it. But, and so that was made public today.
So in your opinion, Governor Noem should at this point issue a public health emergency?
I believe she should. One of the good things that happened last week was that the state and the major hospital systems across South Dakota have arrived on the same page as far as the predictive modeling of the coronavirus in South Dakota. And that was a huge step in a state known for doing its own thing from one person to the next. So there's a unified understanding of the disease and then the threat that exists. And the number one goal in South Dakota right now relative to this disease should be preventing our hospital systems from being overrun. And all of the modeling that you see, the numbers of infections and the number of intensive care and estimates of the number of ventilators needed and so on, that's just for COVID-19 patients. That does not take into account the usual medical caseloads that exist in our hospitals where ventilators are needed and emergency procedures and hospital stays are needed. So the number one goal is to keep from overwhelming the system, because then the fatality rate will go way higher than it needs to go during the peak infection period. So I think we're,
if the system is overrun, the fatality peak will be higher than necessary, than it needed to be, is what you're saying.
It absolutely will, not only from COVID-19, but from things that would not necessarily have to be in that higher fatality rate, you know, the typical cardiac conditions and breathing problems and, you know, cancer and all types of things that are pretty well mitigated normally will go for, in some cases, unchecked because of the lack of resources available.
So when we looked at that modeling and representatives from Monument Health and Avera and Sanford all going to appear to be part of the governor's press conference on Friday, and we saw that, you know, getting, as you say, getting on the same page, you know, for what, you know, what predictive modeling we're using. In the asterisks of, you know, where that curve was and how we were flattening that curve was, you know, if current mitigation techniques are still used, a lot of people were arguing that more could be done and we could flatten that curve even further, but it felt like people were trying to hit that Goldilocks zone of, you know, like how much can we hurt the economy and how many lives can we save? Do you think that the state is doing, and the city, in your city, enough to save as many lives as possible? Could we flatten that curve more?
I think we could flatten the curve more, but I'll tell you one thing I definitely agree with the governor on, and that is that the primary responsibility for personal safety falls on the individual, the primary responsibility, not the cumulative responsibility. But we are all responsible for how we act. We drive safely. We don't walk into traffic. We have a self-preservation instinct that should be speaking to us right now in terms of staying out of crowds of people and not going to typical activities and all of that type of thing. So, you know, it's a very important time right now where the government does its part, the communities do its part, but I think it's predictable that we're going to be coming on a time when there is a real need to start balancing the economic damage being done with the mitigation efforts. For example, to continue to lock down more and more and more will create, among other things, a health crisis with mental health. There's already spikes in mental health incidents and treatment being needed. And poverty is just as threatening to one's health as many diseases. And plus, unfortunately, when the government acts, there's also a political component. So right now, we have good compliance in Rapid City. We have a number of businesses closed by city ordinance, but a number are closed either by corporate decisions or by business owner decisions. So that's all going well, and we're in our second week of that now. So if we go another couple of weeks, there are going to be more and more people who cannot pay bills, who start experiencing more stress, who are, you know, unable to pay for the essentials needed for survival. And politically, they're going to be lobbying towards elected officials to open up or partially open up or do more in the way of getting us back to normal. So I think it's predictable that we could see a partial or metered reopening of businesses even before we're at the peak of this disease, which is going to seem completely counterintuitive to all of us, because academically, you just keep everything closed until the worst of it is past. Well, if that's 2 months down the road, there are a number of problems that will creep up. And I doubt our political ability to keep things closed over a long term. So that's just a reality. I think that we should be talking about when we reopen, how to do so without increasing or reversing all of the positive effects we've seen so far. So that's where the discussions are right now.
What do you know about, when we look at the statewide data, what's going to happen in Rapid City? What's going to happen in your area? Do you have enough supplies? Does Monument Health have enough supplies to handle the surge that you're expecting?
Well, I'll say two things that sound contradictory, but you should expect no less from a politician. One thing is, logically, no, there won't be enough supplies. There won't be enough ventilators. There won't be enough masks, gloves, gowns, all that type of thing, because the supply is not there today. However, this country, this state, and this community have the ability to do great things. And we're already seeing a tremendous community effort to pick up the slack in the supply of those materials. So we have bridge clubs, sewing groups that are doing, making masks. And we have people with 3D printers printing out the reusable masks. And we have a local company here that is reverse engineering and retrofitting a type of respirator that will be better than the N95 medical mask. And so all of these things, we're going to start seeing the benefits of these things very soon. And I think we have the ability then to pick up that slack and to meet the need of our healthcare professionals. I think we'll meet the need. So that's supplies. The other problem we have potentially is the hospital rooms. We're going to need more hospital rooms than we have inventory of right now today in some of our communities. And people think about, Monument Health in Rapid City. Well, Rapid City's population, 77,000 people, and right there is the first mistake. Monument Health does not just treat people from the Rapid City limits or just the Metropolitan Service Area. They treat into Wyoming, part of Nebraska, most of West River. So Monument Health service area is 450,000 people. And so that has to be figured in to the local version of this disease modeling that suggests if we do everything right and if the disease progresses as predicted, we'll run out of rooms and run out of essential equipment near the peak of that spread. So to that extent, Monument is building hospital rooms in some of their partially constructed new facility. They've been remodeling for a couple of years or building on for a couple of years. And they're now building rooms in those new areas, which was not the original plan. And the National Guard's coming out to build space. And so we're seeing a lot of, again, a lot of that community effort. And there is a plan to move into off-campus locations and to use surrounding hospitals and other facilities for health care. And keeping in mind, this is a very important thing, the predictive modeling that we've seen, that is nothing more than a planning tool. It's not a predetermination of doom on a specific date. That the primary purpose of that is to allow the healthcare professionals to plan appropriately for all of our good.
Do you feel that you are weighing in the balance human lives who could die from everything from COVID-19 to heart attacks and keeping a restaurant open on a daily basis?
No, not today. We're not. I think it's very clear that South Dakota has taken lesser actions than some of the surrounding states. Well, most of the surrounding states. And so I think there's a lot of room there for improvement. But on the other hand, there's also evidence that what we are doing is producing a positive result. But in the end, in the most extreme form of your question, if we save an additional life, but we are in a worse economic collapse than the Depression, then where was there a point of diminishing return? Where do we save one life from the disease but cost a life from the other effects of the ruined economy? So now what I just said was not money should take priority over health. But unfortunately, that's the common reaction to someone talking about keeping the economy going. People need jobs to buy food. There's not enough government money to buy food for everyone. And so we look at some of those parts of the economy that are still going strong, like construction and land development. In fact, we're up from this time last year. And so those employ, you know, 1,000 people in our community, and that's important. So we're not at the point of splitting hairs and deciding what to open at whose risk yet. But I'm just saying logically, and this is a result of my opinion or my lack of confidence in the very system I work in, I think there will be a point when the public demands that these restrictions, even nationwide, be lifted. And that's going to be hard for a citizen government not to listen, at least partially, to what they're saying.
Do you think the economic stimulus package and the increase in unemployment insurance benefits and the paycheck protection program and these things that are arguably mm-hmm. having a rough start in execution and getting money into people's pockets, but do you think in the end those are not enough to sustain the economy in order to save lives for the public health crisis that we're in?
No, I think they will be enough for a time. But
because thousands of more people dying isn't good for the economy either.
No, you're right. And I'm not saying anything to the contrary, but the imposition of, you know, a comparable martial law on a community also causes a number of problems as well as solving them. And so I think it's our job to keep our ear to the ground, keep intelligence gathering with our local health care communities, and get enough advice and have those timely contacts so that we know how other states who will peak before us how they have recovered. Mm. There'll be a time for us. This is a time for us to protect ourselves right now. And there will come a time when it's our time to recover from the pandemic. And I just, all I'm saying here is I don't believe there's a date on the calendar where we end with one mission and pick up a new mission on the next day. I think there'll be an overlapping of reopening and re-stimulating the economy while the disease is on its way down in the numbers.
Just one more
and
thing.
And I'm afraid that that'll...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
There's one more thing
well,
I want
to... I'm afraid that that'll look like we're... Well, sorry. I'm afraid that when we do that, when we start to rebuild, that that will appear to be a cold-hearted, money-grubbing, non-caring approach to it. And I think it's really incumbent upon us as government officials to make sure we're making the best decisions with the best information available.
There seems to be scientific consensus and political will that, you know, the more testing that you can do and the more contact tracing that you can do is the sort of way to move forward with an economy and protecting people's health. If you could, in a fantasy world, have universal daily testing of people and rigorous contact tracing, this would be an entirely different story. Do you see in Rapid City, through Monument Health, or through the state of South Dakota, those massive efforts to increase the amount of testing and rapid response testing and contact tracing that would really be needed to make a difference in how we deal with this pandemic? Because we have had time that New York City didn't have. We have had time that, China, South Korea didn't have. But we look to some of those places and we see how they handled it, and the evidence seems to be clear that the best way to handle it is with massive amounts of testing and vigorous contact tracing.
Right. Yeah, I wish that is a great fantasy scenario. I wish it were that way. I wish we had warehouses full of testing materials and that they could be used at will. One of the things that I'd like to point out, though, is that South Dakota has today 280 positive tests, but 5,000, more than 5,000 negative tests. And that's after screening procedures where they're trying to isolate the people who are the most likely to be positive before they test them. And so I think that provides a little reassurance that, the lack of testing is not contributing greatly to the spread at the moment. So, and hopefully, as the weeks go on, we'll have access to some better testing, better procedures as far as identifying it. But this is very frustrating for the community. People have sent me messages saying, I know for a fact my father has COVID-19, but he can't get tested. He has had a cough. He's had this and he has that. He hasn't had a fever, but he has all these other things, and they won't test him, and this is wrong. That's very, very frustrating. People want to be tested on demand when the medical professionals are saying, your father does not fit the profile of the symptoms for COVID-19, so we can't spend this testing material on him when we need it somewhere else. And we also have with flu season now, and we have, this is the time where lots of folks are sick. So it is very frustrating. But, and if you had 300 million tests available and you could test every man, woman, and child in the country, then we would know where we're at on that day. But you need another 300 million very shortly down the road to see if anyone else has contracted it. And then we have the young people's response to it as well. I mean, young people may not even know they're sick. They may just have a mild cough and be able to spread the disease without drawing any attention to anyone who would test them. So there's for every philosophical best case scenario, there's a nearly an equal philosophical worst-case scenario or a con to the whole argument. But I know this, we're stuck here now with this situation, and there'll be plenty of time for finger-pointing after as far as who dropped the ball or who didn't prepare us. But I think so far South Dakota's done very well in keeping ourselves as healthy as practical.
What do you want to see happen next?
Well, what I want to see happen next is that the governor would declare a public health emergency to let the communities across the state govern appropriately for their individual needs, the community's individual needs and collective needs. And I want us to find hope in all of this dreary information that's out there today. We've all been preconditioned today by the Surgeon General that this week's going to be a horrible week, and that the next 30 days are going to be very important, and so on and so forth. And so I just want our communities to be able to see some light at the end of the tunnel and to fully understand what we what we're up against here. And for most of us, we've never been up against this before.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.